Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello, my name is Ashley Beeman, and you're listening to Interchange for Tuesday, August 16th, 2011. Tonight we have two news segments for you. The first segment is a discussion with Sandra Tokarski and Laura McHarrison. Sandra and her husband, Thomas Tokarski, recently filed a lawsuit in federal court in Indianapolis to halt the construction of I-69. Tonight's second segment features an interview with Bryce Medley, who is a local representative of the Communications Workers of America. He has come to the firehouse to talk about the recent dismissal of 8 Wells library workers and the ramification of these firings, especially in light of a 23% raise given to University President McRobbie. Now, our first segment with reporter Ryan Dawes, Sandra Tokarski, and attorney Mick Harrison.
Thank you very much, Ashley, and thank you listeners for joining us here on Interchange. As she said, I'm joined here with Sandra Tokarski. Sandra works with Citizens for Appropriate Rural Roads. It's a local transportation advocacy group. In this case, we're focusing on their role in opposing the new train, Interstate I-69. I'm also joined with Mick Harrison. He is an attorney who is assisting Carr and other plaintiffs in opposing I-69 through a legal action that was filed earlier this month, a legal complaint disputing some of the legalities with construction of I-69. Sandra and Mick, thank you both very much for joining us here on Interchange.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Great. So, Sandra, first of all, I want to talk a little bit about who's involved and why, and also what is their stake in, preventing I-69 through coming through South Central Indiana. And how I want to do that is just go through and talk a little bit about some of the plaintiffs listed in this case that was filed earlier this month, and talk a little bit about what is their stake, how will they be affected by I-69 if it does in fact pass through as the way it is currently planned.
Well, the suit was filed by our organization, which we, Citizens for Appropriate Rural Roads, we use the acronym CAR, and a number of other people, average citizens. There is another organization called the I-69 Accountability Project, which is basically Bloomington-based citizens who are concerned about the impacts of I-69 on their community. And some of the individual plaintiffs have, in fact, a stake in terms of loss of their land and their property. Some other people, for example, CAR, our organization, has over 700 families that are members. And those people, the majority of those are not people who are impacted by the highway personally in a physical way, but they are concerned about the terrible impact that building another interstate highway has on our farmland and our forest land throughout Southwest Indiana.
You and your husband and the property you own will be affected by I-69. Talk a little bit about, the communication you've had with the state, and also, what is it going to do to your lives? How is it going to impact, your property, your routines? Put a face to it.
Well, this project has so impacted our lives for 20 years that it's hard to get a grasp on what happens if this suit is not successful, if the state goes ahead and continues and builds another interstate highway. It's just...
So actually, how about start off just by talking about physically describe your property, and then also, as it's been communicated to you, how will it look after I-69 if in fact it does go through as planned?
Okay, my husband and I are very blessed, and we have about 35 acres in the southwest part of Monroe County. Our house sits nearly a quarter mile off the county road. The property is mostly wooded. The number of the farm fields that were there when we first bought the place, we have either allowed to go back to woods, or we have planted, you know, well over 1,000 trees to improve the forest and improve the habitat. Having an old house that is a quarter mile off the county road and having an interstate highway go by it, it's not how we chose to live. But I really have to say, because we do get asked this question a lot about how it's going to impact you, how's it going to impact the Tokarskis, this project is having a terrible impact on the lives of people all up and down the route. Some of the people have already lost their land. Good farmland has been paved over. And there's no excuse for this. There's no good, sound transportation reasons to build I-69.
I see. So now, Mick, I'd like to ask you a little bit about some of the defendants in this case, and why are they being involved, and what are the various, you know, what are the various discrepancies you have with, you know, the way they're acting, and, you know, what they can do to mitigate, in your eyes, this situation?
Sure. The defendants are the Federal Department of Transportation and the state NDOT, Indiana Department of Transportation, and their officials. They're essentially guilty of the same things, violating federal environmental laws. Those federal laws include NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is, most people know it by the law that requires the environmental impact statements for major federal projects. And they're violating the Endangered Species Act, in this case, in particular, in regard to not protecting the endangered Indiana bat, which is a species named after our home state, and is unfortunately facing some fairly serious threats to its survival at the moment, I-69 being one of them. They're also violating the Clean Air Act, and so those are the three biggest, I guess one would call, patterns of violations. We want these agencies to simply comply with the law, and I can tell you, if you wish, a little more detail about what that would require of them. But if they do comply with the law, and for example, they were to do what NEPA requires, they would have to do a legitimate environmental impact statement, not a sham. What they've done so far is, in our view, basically a sham.
Now tell me why you think that's a sham.
Well, it's not been honest. For example, when they did the first round of the EIS some years back in 2001, 2003, they concealed material information about the adverse impacts on the Indiana environment. Most folks know Southwest Indiana has a lot of karst. Karst features. Bloomington has a lot of karst. Caves, sinkholes, sinking streams, and so forth. Very sensitive environmental ecosystems involved with the karst environment. They hid a study that had been done back in 1994, they being NDOT and Federal Highway, and they didn't disclose it to the public during the public comment period on the EIS. And they went ahead and approved the project, minimizing sort of the real impacts, hiding them from the public. And then some members of the public discovered the study and that it had been concealed. And the judge said, well, okay, yeah, they should have disclosed it. But if there really are too many impacts on karst, you can fix the problem when you do the second phase of the EIS. Well, our second phase just came out July 22nd or so.
Something like that.
For Section 4, what they call the Tier 2 EIS. And again, we find out they're still playing games hiding the karst information.
So what is this karst information that you say they are hiding? And also, what is so bad about it?
Well, if you think about it, I mean, you're building an interstate highway through areas which have sinkholes, caves, streams. There are a lot of adverse impacts from interrupting a stream. There are a lot of species that depend on the stream. We take the Indiana bat as an example. It forages for insects along streams in wooded areas. It hibernates in the winter in caves, okay? And right now it's facing a very dire threat from what's called the white nose syndrome. It's a fungus that's killing bats in the eastern states and has now been found in Indiana just recently. It's wiping out entire populations of bats, 90% or more mortality in the caves that are impacted by the white nose syndrome, and now it's in Indiana. The problem is if you build a highway in a karst area, you can change the flow of the water, you can change the airflow to caves, and you can alter what's called the microclimate in the hibernacula. Hibernacula is a fancy word for the caves the bats winter in. And they have very restrictive conditions in which they can survive over the winter, because they barely survive as it is under ideal circumstances. And so if you change the temperature, you change the airflow, you change the humidity, or if you flood the cave, you can wipe out an entire population. And I-69 threatens to do that. And so in order for us to determine just how big of a risk is I-69 to the Indiana bat, we have to know what caves will be impacted, what sinkholes will be impacted, what streams will be impacted, in other words, what karst features, by the construction of the highway. And it's also its induced development impacts. It's going to cause growth around the highway, which is going to impact these same features. So we find out just a couple weeks ago that when they released the final EIS for Section 4, they reference an appendix, a study in an appendix. The appendix was named NN, Nancy Nancy, and it was a karst study that was addressing comments by citizens from Bloomington who had proposed a new route, a change in the route to avoid karst impacts, to avoid caves and to avoid sinkholes. And so they contracted, NDOT contracted with a company to do a study to see if they should really consider this alternative route. So they did the study, we found that out, and they found out that the route that citizens proposed would save $35 million and avoid a big chunk of the karst features, would avoid a lot of the adverse environmental impacts. And then we realized a few days later, they modified their EIS and they deleted reference in the public comment section to the, having this study done, and they pretended it had never happened. And they didn't release the study to the public. They're concealing it as we speak.
So I'm curious, go back to the discussing the bats and, okay, you know, where else can they go? How unique is this particular habitat? You know, can they go someplace else or?
Okay, well, Sandra, maybe you can start and I can.
Okay.
The Indiana bat is, to me, I'm beginning to realize, kind of fascinating creature. This is a little animal that weighs about the same as an average house key. And its wingspan is between 9.5 and 10.5 inches. And they tend to go to the same places that they've gone before, which is, you know, when the habitat where they've been living has been destroyed. For example, a lot of the forested areas in southwestern Indiana, you clear the forest and then there's no place for them to go, and it causes stresses on the bats to find out, you know, to find another place where they're happy to either raise their young. They hibernate in the winter in certain caves, and during the summertime they raise their young. The females raise their young typically in wooded areas. They like to get underneath the bark of loose bark and on a number of species of trees. And you know, we've been doing this a long time, and we have talked to a wide range of people over the years, from very, very conservative to, you know, very, very liberal. And oftentimes people think, well, why is there all this fuss about a little bat? And in fact, the bats are an indicator species, and they are the canary in the coal mine. So if we do damage to a species, we are ultimately harming ourselves. And right now there's a whole lot of research that's being done on the bat because of the white nose syndrome. But the bottom line is, this is a species that could become extinct in a very short order. They're under stress. In general, bats, not just the Indian bat, but all bats are under stress from the development that is spreading throughout southwest Indiana. But with the Indiana bat, because they are a cave They hibernate in caves, and they are the white nose syndrome is impacting them, adding the added stress of having a great deal of the habitat where they live destroyed through logging, through clearing the land for and paving it over. It's very likely that that bat could be lost.
Let me add just a couple numbers. In a former life, before I became a lawyer, I was a teacher of mathematics. And so the numbers, you know, sort of mean something to me. The Indiana bat, named after our state, has 50% of its world population in Indiana. So half of all Indiana bats live here. And now this bat is facing, you know, this threat of extinction from the white nose syndrome, which is a fungus, a newly discovered fungus that's wiping bats out in the eastern states. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimated in a report done on I-69 that the white nose syndrome is likely to kill at least 60% of the Indiana bats in Indiana. Okay, and that's probably an underestimate because it's the mortality in the east is 90% or more from this threat. So what we're talking about is a bat that's going to be lucky to survive if there were no other threats to its survival just because of white nose syndrome.
You're not linking I-69 to white nose syndrome, but just another article you're saying, so what does that mean?
Yeah, I am linking it because I-69 can exacerbate the white nose syndrome threat. No one in the government has yet acknowledged what has caused the white nose syndrome. It was an outbreak that started in 2005?
2006 is when it was first discovered.
So it's very recent. It's a mystery as to why this is happening. It may have to do with the immune system of the bat that's compromised. It may have to do with something about the microclimate of caves has changed. It's hard to say. But the problem is, this is a fungus. It grows in moist environments. If you change the karst features near the hibernacula in Indiana, and you start getting drainage into the caves, either from runoff from the highway, or maybe a toxic spill, or maybe you change the karst water flow and it floods a cave, or you just make it less or more moist, you may make the bats more vulnerable to this fungus or more difficult for them to survive after they're exposed to it for a number of reasons. So they're related. It's not just that I-69, you know, is the only problem, but it may exacerbate the bat's ability to survive white nose.
Great. So let's sort of switch gears a little bit. And what I want to, you know, wonder from you two is think about the best possible outcome of this and then contrast this with what you think the most likely possible outcome is with this
lawsuit,
yes.
Well, I mean, one outcome that we would like is we do intend to ask the federal court, hopefully tomorrow, to issue an injunction stopping all work in I-69 while the litigation goes forward. And we hope when the litigation is finished that Federal Highway and NDOT will see the light, if you will. And if they don't, that the judge will order them to adjust their ways, do a new environmental impact study, looking at alternatives that make more sense. CARS promoted an alternative that has much fewer environmental impacts for years. It's cheaper. It doesn't use new terrain. It follows existing highway routes. It's sort of the common sense alternative. And I think we'd like to see them basically go that way, to follow what CARS has been suggesting for 20 years, which is the alternative that makes sense, that's cheaper, it takes less out of the environment. So that's the ideal. Now, what is the likely outcome? I mean, I've stopped trying to predict what judges will do in litigation. I've been doing this for 20 years. We've won a number of cases, but it's kind of hard to predict. So, you know, I'll let Sandra sort of speak to your question as well, but I think it's litigation to me always has an unknown outcome, and you know it's sort of over when it's over.
What about you? Do you have a you know, if you're going to sit and daydream, what is the best possible outcome? And then, given that you've been working on this for about 25 years, you know, what do you think is going to happen? Not only with the current complaint that's been filed, but also the litigation which you're going to, you know, file tomorrow regarding the injunction.
What I guess my daydream would be is that we would, and this is really a daydream, that we would, the agencies, the Department of Transportation in Indiana and the Federal Highway Administration, would start to listen to citizens, and they would start to promote truly sound, sustainable transportation policies. We cannot keep the roads that we have in good repair. This project will be taking, at least $1 billion and maybe more than that from the existing funding mechanism for highways in the state. And it's not sustainable. We can't continue to keep paving over our farmland and forest. There are a lot of things that could be done that would improve transportation throughout the state, and particularly in Southwest Indiana, and we've been saying these for a long time, upgrade and improve existing roads. That doesn't mean make every road an interstate. It means put in 8 to 10 foot wide paved shoulders, put in turning lanes where they're appropriate, left turn lanes, right turn lanes, put passing lanes on any very steep inclines, and generally have the transportation system be planned for people and for communities and not for the big highway construction lobby that gives huge campaign donations to politicians. Right now, this project, I-69, is a poster child for this. Our transportation decisions are made by whoever gives the biggest campaign donations to elected officials.
Now, what I want to know, and this is a sort of a debate that is always raging on, and it doesn't seem like it has any end in sight, is does the state have money for this? The activism against I-69 says, no, there's no money for this, yet NDOT and Governor Daniels say, yes, this is funded, yes, we will be able to pay for this. Why cannot this argument be resolved?
I just guess I would like to say, what all those in the room who believe everything that elected officials tell you is true, please raise your hand. The governor, through the long-term lease of the Northern Indiana Toll Road, raised a lot of money. $700 million of that was committed to I-69. If you look at the numbers carefully, you can see that that is not enough to build the entire highway from Interstate 64 up to Indianapolis. There's a lot of ways that the Department of Transportation can play with numbers, and one of the ways that they do that is to only look at certain things that, particularly, okay, so they might say, okay, this is for construction costs and things are coming in way under budget. But what they don't acknowledge when they say those things is that the contractors and the consulting firms are going to be coming in afterwards saying, oh, well, we have to make this change. Let's add this to it. Let's add this to it. Let's add this to it. That's a common thing. It happens all the time, not just on I-69, but on other projects too.
Now, Mick, how can these methods be contended with in sort of a legal arena?
Well, that's a good question. My colleagues at Greenfire Consulting, who've been helping me look at the number crunching on the financial issues, have come up with sort of a history of what's happened on financing of I-69 over the years. And I was educated on this by their work, and my colleague Rudy Savage is helping me do this lawsuit as well. We sort of looked at what they came up with, and the short version is the governor never really had a plan for funding most of I-69. It got started with the $700 million Sandra mentioned with the toll road money, and then there was sort of a, well, we hope to raise money some other way. And they called it innovative financing. And they didn't identify what the innovative procedures would be to raise the money. And only in the last few years, I would say the last couple of years, has the governor decided to, okay, we tried two or three things for innovative financing. They didn't work. We couldn't make I-69 a toll road. We couldn't use this, the 465 connector,
the Commerce Connector.
Commerce Connector. So the innovative things failed. So the governor recently told Federal Highway, we're going to have to use gas tax money for this. And people don't realize what that means. It means that about $2 billion of money that was supposed to be spent for maintaining roads and building projects in other communities, statewide transportation projects, is now being taken away from those other communities, and they don't know it yet. And it's going to be used to fund I-69. And that's the only way they're going to be able to do it. And they haven't disclosed in the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act process, in their EIS, all these impacts on the other communities whose projects are not going to be funded. And to answer your question, the way we're trying to fix this problem is we're trying to hold the governor and NDOT accountable for doing a correct environmental impact statement that admits to the public, okay, here's where we're taking the money from to fund I-69. Here are all the projects that aren't going to be funded, and here are all the impacts, including economic impacts, to these other communities that we haven't talked about that are going to result from having to fund I-69. And if the judge agrees with us, he's going to order the state and the Federal Highway to inform the public and all these communities that, okay, here's where the money's coming from. And we think that may create a political solution to our problem.
Interesting. So now we just got a few minutes left in the segment. And what I'd like to know from you is, you know, what are some of the dates and what's next for not only Carr, but also the injunction you plan on filing tomorrow? Talk a little bit about you, Sandra, a little bit about what Carr plans on doing to continue these efforts. And also, Mick, what is sort of the schedule and timeline of events for this injunction? What you can expect, what sort of, you know, what arena will this be disputed over?
Okay.
Carr will continue to do what we've been doing. Our main mission is to educate people about the impacts of highway construction in rural communities, and we will continue to do that. And the lawsuit is a big thing right now, and we've been all very busy working on that to prepare for it. But that is just one part of our work. What our work is to inform people and to make sure they have accurate information on what I-69 will do to our communities.
And how about the legal efforts? What's the timeline of events for that looking to the future?
Well, Ryan, we expect to be in federal court shortly on our emergency request for an injunction, temporary injunction. That's likely to happen within a week. It depends on the court schedule. We'll then ask for a preliminary injunction, which will be require a second hearing probably in a few weeks. That'll be more like a trial type hearing where there'll be witnesses called and exhibits presented. A trial may be 6 months to a year down the road.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Mick, and you too as well, Sandra. I'm here with Mick Harrison, attorney, who is helping out the Citizens for Appropriate Rural Roads in a in litigation against several state and federal government entities regarding the I-69 case. We're going to head over for a quick break, and then we'll be right back here on Interchange.
Support for WFHB comes from Bloomington Realty. With offices at 713 South Walnut Street in Bloomington, Bloomington Realty is a community realtor serving Bloomington and surrounding counties for over 15 years. Available today for all your real estate needs. More information is available by calling 323-2323. And support comes from Bloom Magazine, proud underwriter of community radio. Bloom Magazine is celebrating its 5th anniversary. In the August-September issue of Bloom, look for It's a Wonderful Town, 50 Reasons to Love Bloomington, plus The Girls of Meadowood, and The Life and Legacy of T.C. Steele. Bloom Magazine is available at more than 200 businesses in the Bloomington area. More information is available at magbloom.com.
the second segment, WFHB Assistant News Director Allison Bechtesh talks with union leader Bryce Medley and the library co-worker Lisa Cameron about the recent cut of 8 positions at Wells Library, including Lisa's job.
I'm Allison Bechtesh for Interchange. In the firehouse today, I have with me Bryce Medley, who is the president of the CWA Local 4730, which is the union for IUB support staff, as well as IU Northwest clerical and technical staff. Thanks for coming in tonight, Bryce.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us later in the show will be Lisa Cameron, who is one of the 10 IU library staff who lost their job this month. Bryce, can you start just by filling us in on the situation that occurred at the IU library 2 weeks ago?
Well, 2 weeks ago that they had informed 10 employees that they'd no longer have a job. I mean, one nice thing to say about the library is that they had really, you know, always telling someone that they're not going to have a job is bad enough, but library did it as best they could to at least provide them additional weeks of working to find placement. And they've gone out of their way actually to try to find them other jobs, either on campus or off campus. But the truth is that 10 people have lost their jobs. They may still be working, but when that time period's up, they'll no longer work for IU. And this is really kind of backed up with what had happened the week before these layoffs. And that was with President McRobbie, where we all learned in Bloomington and even throughout the state that he had given himself a $95,000 raise. So he had gone from, in 2010, his wage was $437,000 and had gone from that to $533,000. And so for many of us on campus who are support staff, professors or faculty, or professional staff, we were given a 1.5%. So it was really hard for us to swallow. Why are we asked to sacrifice all the time, yet the top administrators on campus are making their fortunes? And so we really kind of, you know, we use the library as an example of, to show that, you know, this just isn't fair. You know, we know that there's monies allocated from the legislature to the trustees, and then through the trustees and McRobbie kind of allocate how that's divided amongst the universities. It just isn't fair when so many people make so much money, but they're not asked to sacrifice along the rest of us. So it was just very bad timing on their part. And so we wanted to make a point of it and kind of stand up and say, this isn't right, this isn't fair. If we're all going to sacrifice, we should sacrifice together and maybe kind of do what they did in Purdue, where the president had taken a 3.5% raise instead of a McRobbie raise, which was close to 22%.
The CWA has been very vocal regarding this issue, and you sent out a public request to President McRobbie asking him to take that average 1.5% raise. Did he acknowledge that request?
No. We have called for meetings to, I've actually never met him. We've always requested to meet with him just to introduce ourselves, since we represent 1,700 support staff. It would be nice to actually sit down and kind of talk about the realities that support staff face on campus. Yet we've always been referred to the vice president of human resources, who we have a good relationship with. But at some point, it would be nice if he could actually open up and allow us to sit down and talk to him briefly about just kind of what we face. You know, a livable wage has been argued to me in Monroe County is around $13 an hour. For many of us, we make well below that. I know for the first 2 years on campus that I had worked there, I had made $11. And so after taxes and everything, that's a little less than $600 after 2 weeks. And if you have rent, car payment, insurance, car insurance, you have no money left. And so it's just not fair that we ask so much from these people, but we don't pay them a fair wage. And that really comes to the question that we really pose to the president and to the trustees and to everyone. And that is, how much is too much to get paid to run a public state university, and how much is too little to work for it? And we'd like an answer to that question. I mean, we had heard the trustees and some other people, and I had seen it in the postings on internet. Well, McRobbie's like a CEO, and if he had been a CEO, this would be in line with the raise. Well, McRobbie's not a CEO. He's a professor from informatics. He's never been a chair of a department. He's never been a dean of a department. He has done a relatively good job being president. Yet in that, in his years of service, we have seen costs go up for employees. Parking has gone up. Healthcare premiums are going up. Benefits like tuition, we get a little bit of tuition assistance if we decide to take a class. Those costs have gone up. Continuing education is being axed in June. people at the library are losing their jobs. And so, and at the same time, students are actually asked to carry more of the financial responsibility too with this repair and rebuild the old buildings that built. McRobbie's done a really good job at pushing the cost on others while making a fortune. And in some ways, I've heard some people kind of refer to them as McRobbie, as in the McDonald's. And what we're really getting in this community is really fast food education. And none of us want to work for a fast food chain. We want a community that students get the best education they can get, people get paid fairly for the work they do, and when we're asked to sacrifice, everyone's asked to sacrifice.
You mentioned that you represent thousands of workers within the IU system. Can you talk a little bit more about the CWA role on campus?
Well, our agreement is with the trustees, and so that's why we're allowed to function on campus. We actually represent staff here in Bloomington and at Gary, at IU Northwest. So one of our biggest responsibilities that we do is we advocate on behalf of employees. We're an open shop, which means people can either choose to join our union or not. And so out of 1,700 people, we don't have 1,700 members, but we have members, many of them, but people can choose to either join and pay their fair share or not. Often, though, when people are in trouble or they need assistance, we're the first people there to help them, to advocate. We bargain wages. We also policy. And so many of the policies and rights that support staff have been negotiated because of the union. And so some of these policies would be sick time, overtime, comp hours, a lot of things we take for granted. But unfortunately, on campus, we only get to see people sometimes when they're in trouble. And they come to us and they realize, you mean you're here for us even if I'm not a dues-paying union member? And we say, of course we are. And we help them through that process. And that's really the benefit we do. I think we're also kind of a socially aware organization that is really in touch with the struggles of employees and the issues that Monroe County faces. So we really go out of our ways to reach out across the campus with the gay and lesbian transgender organization the Office of Women's Affairs and multiple organizations, because their issues are our issues and our issues are their issues, and every job is really a union job. And so we build bridges, we work collectively, and we take on issues that are hard. The library layoffs were difficult for everyone. They're extremely difficult for those who lost their job, but even the stewards who work in the library, who have worked year after year creating really good relationships with HR there. And we're really proud of their service. And we had stewards who sat in on these RIF meetings, and that was really hard on our stewards, because it's hard to see someone be told they lost their job. And so we do a lot. Everything we do, though, is really on behalf of the employee. And that's the beautiful thing about unions on campuses. Without it, then we have no organization to look to and to, you know, become, you know, active participants in the discussion on campus.
Well, can you talk a little bit more about these recent library layoffs? What power did you have as a union? What was done or what could have been done to prevent this or argue for the employees?
Well, we really had no power over, you know, who lost their jobs and who didn't. You know, the library is going through a reorganization. And we had all read from Mark Land in the newspaper, the IU spokesperson, that as technology is developing, that they've had to do some restructuring. And so when it comes to, you know, there is nothing we could do to prevent them from losing their jobs. But what we could do is bear witness to how they're treated when they're told they're losing their jobs. And so we were afforded the ability to sit in on those RIFs. We had at least three stewards who sat in on all those RIFs to lend support to the employee. Our office has also has been organizing packets, and we've also, you know, we're communicating with people that if they want to come to our office and use our copy machine, need resume help, that we will give them assistance. So a lot of times what stewards do, and I think unions do, is that we bear witness. We make sure that policy's followed, that people who have seniority have bumping rights, that people who, you know, the way that they're treated is transparent and fair. And that's really what we want to do, and that we provide advocacy for these employees. Whether or not, you know, the employee who got RIF 2 weeks ago was in the union, does not matter. We are going to help everyone out who's an IU support staff on campus and make sure that we make it right and do the best we can do.
So when the Mark Land said that the libraries transitioning to use technology better, does that mean that the jobs that were just eliminated are being replaced by computers? What kind of staff was let go?
Well, there's a combination of staff that was let go. He had also said that some of the positions were redundant. And so there was some catalog. There was across the board. It kind of touched upon different areas that they thought they could, do without. One of the trends, though, on campus that's been really alarming, and I actually started at cyclotron rifts last year and throughout campus, is that they are letting people go and they're not filling those positions, but they're asking the remaining staff who remain behind to do the extra work. And so I'm aware of many cases across campus, all over the university, where people have been let go, or we had just gone through an early retirement process where many support staff had taken the early retirement, yet they're not filling those positions. So at the same time, we're trying to reorganize and save money and be more efficient, but we're not going to pay who's still there working any additional money, even though we've given them, double the workload. And so the problem is when you see a lot of these rifts, if it's not really done in a balanced way, and if you're not, I can understand if you have to let people go, at least those that remain get paid fairly for the extra work. And so with the library, it's unfortunate. Unfortunately, it's not the last layoff that we're going to see on campus. We have continuing education that will probably be coming up in June. And we're hoping that the university finds different, positions for these folks on campus. One nice thing, though, under a policy that was negotiated with CWA, is when you get a reduction in force or a layoff, they have about a year that they're called rift rights, essentially, where if another job comes up on campus, that they have to really be given an interview. And the department, if they decide not to hire this person, has to make a really strong case why not. And so one of the nice things about having our union who have negotiated this policy is that just because you're rifted doesn't mean that you can't get another job on campus. The absence of our union on campus, we may not even have that policy, which means you lost your job, you're out. So that's going to hopefully, we're hoping that's going to help most of the folks out. Unfortunately, not everyone's going to have rift rights because someone might have been on probation or there might be other issues that might have kept them. So I think one of the important things that we should remember when we look at layoffs here in our community, and I think I use a good example, is when some people are getting these huge raises, is that we have kind of this attack on middle class and on middle class workers, where people are losing their jobs while other people who are, especially at a state institution, are making their fortunes. And we also see the state legislature in Indiana kind of attack and demonize unions. And I think this is really fed into a misconception about what unions are. I mean, I think a lot of times people think, well, it's all about striking. We don't strike. We can't strike. And that's not even one of our purposes on campus. And so what we've seen in Wisconsin and Indiana and throughout the country, and lately, if you've seen the news at Verizon on the East Coast, you've seen this attempt to bust unions and to take away people's right to organize. And that is really fearful, I think. It scares me in a sense because I care so much for the union, like all of my brothers and sisters in the union. But this whole concept that having people organize to advocate for a safer workplace, for a healthier environment where they work, and for benefits, demonizing these things is just, it's startling. I mean, because what are we fighting for? I mean, we're fighting for fair wages, livable wages, pensions, and pensions has become a dirty word. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a pension. I wish every employee, no matter where they worked, had a pension. And lately we have this attack on right, they call it right to work, but the truth is it's right to work for less. So it's this whole attempt to take away people's right to vocalize. Now, if we had no union on campus, I would be scared to sit on this radio program and talk about what had happened at the library or with McRobbie, because I could lose my job. But knowing that I have a union means I can actually speak up and give some constructive criticism in the most respectful way I can.
And of course, we appreciate that. I want to touch back on the rift rights that you mentioned. Do you have any read on what that does for morale? How often does someone who was let go unexpectedly decide to return to that place of employment?
Well, for many support staff, and this is something that we should always remember, there was also rifts that occurred at IU Press within the last year, Cyclotron, now the library, and we have future ones coming up. It should be noted that some of these employees have worked for IU for over 30 years. So if you've spent your entire adult life working for an institution and you find out you no longer have a job in 6 weeks, that's devastating. I mean, what do you do? I mean, you know, we could be approaching a double dip recession. There's not a lot of jobs out there right now. A lot of jobs don't want to give their employees healthcare benefits. So these RIF rights are really, really important. And that's something that our union will always fight for and always say that if you work for IU and you're covered by CWA union, we are going to make sure that if you lose your job through a layoff by no fault of your own, I mean, there's nothing that these employees did, that at least for that following year, if there's a job that opens up on the university, you should be given first consideration for that job. And that's critical. And a lot of places don't do that. Most places that don't have unions would never offer anything like that. And so you'll find with a lot of these employees that, you know, I like, you know, they people that work at IU are part of the community. And they want to work at IU because it's a great place to work. There's nice people, intelligent people. We have a highly skilled support staff and faculty. And so people want, you know, they feel that if you spend 30 years at a place, it's a part of your family. And so they want to be, they want to stay at IU. IU just needs to do a better job at being transparent and, you know, make and asking everyone to kind of do a fair share. You know, McRobbie isn't the only one who had received a huge raise. If you look at Neil Theobald, he had given himself, or the trustees, or he had basically been given a $54,000 raise. Applegate, another IU administrator, a $34,000. And so we had done this study that had looked at the top administrators' wage increase. And so if you actually had looked up all their wage increase and you actually had given them only a 1.5 increase like the rest of staff, you're already close to about $230,000. If you can make a savings there, you could have saved some of these people's jobs, and you might potentially save people's jobs in the next few months.
That is quite a discrepancy, but I was wondering if how easy it is to just transfer money. I mean, is that fair to juxtapose those raises with these layoffs? How easy is it to really shift money from one department or from one use, like a raise, to another department like the libraries?
Well, it's done all the time. I mean, throughout the university, you know, President McRobbie and Neil Theobald, the, you know, CFO of the university, I mean, they move money all the time around campus. And so, you know, when you look at deans of schools and programs and heads of departments, I mean, they project their budget. And so I think, you know, you can be efficient. You can move money around. You can eliminate redundant jobs. There's nothing wrong with that. But in one sense, if you're going to do that, you can't just at the day before give yourself, well, we have no money to keep these people, but I just made $95,000, you know, from last year, on top of last year. So I went from $437,000 to $533,000. You know, I would love to have the opportunity to live in Monroe County on $437,000 one year. And if he can't make it on $437,000 in one year, then I would hate for him to live on my wage, which is way under $30,000. And so I think you can make it. I think you can make it happen. But we have to put people first and realize that people that lose their jobs, it impacts our local community, it impacts their family. It's devastating. It's demoralizing. And if we do have to make these sacrifices, which everyone will have to make these sacrifices at some time, we make sure we do it in a fair way by not making our fortunes off their losses.
You alluded to future layoffs coming up, and I know that one reason IU has attributed their cutting back is because the state is not funding education the way it has in previous years. And if this continues, what else is at risk?
I think a lot is really at risk here. I mean, we have I heard a piece of news today. It says, "How do you know if you have the worst governor in the state?" And I think we have one of the worst governors in the country. We have a terrible governor that does not care about working families, does not care about the middle class, who has set up the funding for our state schools in an unfair way. IU has a very high graduation rate. And so as we move forward, they're going to say, they're basically going to allocate money on the graduation rate and then how much you improve from that point. Well, if you already have a super high graduation rate, it's very difficult to move higher up. Compared to if you have a very low graduation rate, it's a lot easier to make improvements. You know, I remember some years ago when I was in high school, the whole debate about should we have a lotto system in the state. And we were convinced that if you have the lottery system in the state, these monies will fund schools. Well, the truth is we have a lottery system in the state, yet the monies that these lotteries raise, the state just deducts what they would give the schools. And so, you know, we've been scammed again. What we really need in this state and throughout the Midwest, I mean, we're in ground zero. We have jobs that are leaving the country, jobs that will never be replaced. We're attacking those who make the least. For most of us who are middle class and not in below and lower the middle class, you know, over the in the poverty line, we're the only ones in the country paying our taxes, while we have part of the country who makes over $1 million who doesn't even pay their taxes. And so we need to really kind of take back our state from the radicalization of the conservative movement. And that is basically profit driven. And I was grown in the Midwest. I'm originally from Ohio, where we were raised to treat people with respect, to pay people for what they're worth, and to stand up when it's time to stand up. And we're doing that. And so we're standing up. And you can only fight your battle in your backyard. And this is our backyard, which is IU and Monroe County and Bloomington. And so we make our stand here. And we say enough is enough. And we do need to pay people fairly, because they do have families and they are a benefit to our community.
You mentioned the conservative side. What do you say to people who associate unions with socialism and also say that in a derogatory way?
Well, as a union president, I've heard many insults hurled my way about unions or socialism. I wouldn't say that we're socialist. I would say that one thing that we stand for is giving the people a vehicle to organize to make sure that they're not going to get killed on the job, that if they're going to do a job, they're going to be as in a safe environment as possible, that if they are going to be critical about policy, that they aren't going to lose their job. I mean, really, the foundation of a union is democracy. Businesses are not democratic. Even the university is not a democratic institution. CWA is a democratic union. We vote for our membership. We vote for our leadership. If our leadership's not good, we vote for new leaders. Everyone has a vote. Everyone has a say. Everyone can talk about how we spend our money and things like that. Our union is neither conservative nor liberal. We are just hardworking Americans. And if you're a Republican and you're pro-labor, you've got an ally. If you're Democrat and you're pro-labor, you've got an ally. But enough is enough when it comes to these politicians who continually undermine the middle class and attack things like pensions, attack things like health care. I'm under the belief that if you work 20 hours a week, you should be provided some sort of health care. And so I'm really proud of how our country has moved to start to socialize health care, just like we've socialized education and just like we have a socialized military. You know, I'm not advocating for socialism, but I'm saying our country is littered with a socialized form of various things. The union, though, is basically a democratic organization that fights for equality and justice for our members and for every hardworking American. And at IU, like I had said earlier, if you're part of our union, great. If you're support staff and you're not part of our union, we really want you to join. But if not, we will still stand beside you in your time of need.
I want to close up looking forward for these the librarians who got laid off. You said that they are still in their jobs, but that will expire. Do you know the timeline for that and where else IU is looking to place them?
Well, IU has made some attempts to put them in some other comparable jobs on campus in the library system. My understanding is they had around 6 weeks. Once those 6 weeks up, their RIFT rights for a year is in place. So they're doing the best they can to try to place them within the university. But we going through RIFTs before, we realized that there's just not enough jobs to place everyone at times. And so we are there. I know HR Library is trying to kind of help these individuals as much as possible to get them the additional training they need to find jobs. But that's the best we can do at this time. And I hope that, with these record enrollments and that we can actually continue to grow the university in a sustainable way and really bring these people back in, because I can contest that every IU employee I've ever met, I've been proud to work alongside with, and they're highly skilled. You know, a lot of people don't realize that many support staff have their college degrees, their masters, some have their PhDs. And these are the people who really truly believe in the community of the university. And we're here for our students. So we need to treat our own the best we can possibly do. And the goal here is that our students see how well we treat our employees, and when they become business leaders, that they in turn also treat their employees with fairness and livable wages. But it all starts here. I mean, education is the building block. So we must start here and make it right now and make it right so it's made right later on.
Bryce, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us at Interchange today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Interchange. If you have any thoughts or questions, contact us at interchange@wfhb.org. That's interchange@wfhb.org. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by Allison Bektash, Ryan Dawes, and William Morris. The executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam. And I'm Ashley Beeman. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman, coming up next on your community radio station, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of community radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.